December 22nd, 2016. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we will review the 2014 book by Tobias Churton, Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Berlin. This is apparently an expansion and compilation of outcuts from the author's biography of Crowley, and should perhaps be considered an appendix to that work. Unless you are an ardent Crowley aficionado, it is a hard read. The book is primarily made up of excerpts from A.C.'s diaries and his correspondence, mostly during his 1930s Berlin sojourn as a struggling artist in the decadent twilight days of the Weimar Republic, along with a running account of the beast's metaphysical, politics, sexual magic, and artistic endeavors. Churton manages to give us an in-depth look at the decadent subculture of the Weimar Berliners and an appreciation of Crowley's talents as an artist. So, if you'd like to accompany the beast to the cabaret, tune in and enjoy the show. Now, this review results from a remark I made on a previous broadcast review of the Codex Homunculus when I said that both Paracelsus and Aleister Crowley were both misogynists. One of our listeners promptly emailed me to take issue. He declared, "Crowley loved women. Just read Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Berlin," he suggested. Well, I admitted that I had not read it, but I thought it might be worth reading and reviewing, especially because of the time and the venue, the decadent era before the collapse of the Weimar Republic, when Berlin was the sin city of the Western world. So I read it, and my first comment to my ardent polemic listener is, I'm sorry, but the book tends to confirm my opinion about Crowley's attitude toward women. However, in his defense, I will say that if he drove them insane, they were probably on that course when they first met him. But I will not go so far as to suggest that this excuses Crowley's sexual and emotional exploitation of them. And The Beast in Berlin gives us a long-running account of this activity in more sordid detail than most modest readers are likely to enjoy. Crowley did say, after Plato, that every man and every woman is a star. But he also extolled the scarlet woman, in whom all power is given. He tended to ignore a woman's nesting and nurturing urge in favor of the less prominent, less mature urge to promiscuity. As one of my wise ladies put it, the law of Thelema is for men, not for women. This goes along with another wise woman's statement, men do, and women are. But to review the book, Churton's main interest is in Crowley the artist, a side of his work that is seldom emphasized. Although Crowley had little or no formal training as an artist, he had the creative genius's natural bent for artistic expression. And as an Edwardian age Renaissance man, he had to try his hand at it. He began squeezing paint directly out of the tubes onto the canvas and only learned to mix his pigments when one of his scarlet women, who had some art training, showed him how. Now, even then, his work still had a primitive quality. But this fitted in well with what the 1920s and 30s Germans were doing, and although they labeled him an outsider, his work was appreciated. The climax of his efforts was a show of 72 works at a Berlin gallery called Porza, P-O-R-Z-A, from October through November of 1932. Now, many of these works have been lost, but the few that are reproduced in the book are very interesting. which is the standard comment a critic makes when he knows a piece of art is good, but he doesn't particularly like it. Now, we get to the Porza exhibit on page 270 of a 364-page book. So most of the book involves Crowley's time in Berlin, living in a garret with his scarlet women, at least four of them, taken from his diaries and correspondence with his friends and associates, Carl Germer and his wife Cora, both in Germany, and Gerald York, Israel Rigardi, and Lieutenant Colonel Nick Carter of Scotland Yard, all in London. His wife Marie was also in London, but in an asylum. Most of his communication involved pleas for money and schemes for shady business deals or libel suits Crowley thought might be lucrative. Crowley was a parasite who constantly begged his friends and associates for money, always promising a rich return on their investment in the products of his genius. Carl Germer, Gerald York, and Israel Rigardi all left Crowley before he died, and all of them returned to claim their portion of his legacy after his decease. Because the book deals with Crowley in Germany, Churton begins with a background episode in the 1920s, when Crowley visits Carl and Cora Germer to attend an esoteric conclave called the WIDA Conference, that's W-E-I-D-A. This chapter introduces us to Crowley's German connections, and especially his ambitions regarding German esoteric affiliations and publishing connections. We review his association with Theodore Roos, Carl Kellner, and the original OTO. The separation of AC's Argentum Astrum, his Thelemized version of the Golden Dawn program, from the OTO dates from this period, and it has lasted to this day. Only Georgina Brayton in the 1960s was ever able to integrate the two systems. We also discover that Crowley was trying to Thelemize the Theosophical Society and sought to replace Krishnamurti with himself upon the death of Annie Besant. One of the delightful episodes at this conference was a nature walk in the nearby forest, where Crowley fascinated his fellow mystics by having animated conversations with invisible elementals as they strolled along the trail. Now, if this had happened today, we would have a video on YouTube of Crowley in his Knickerbocker tweeds, waving his hands and chattering to the bushes. Much later in the book, Churton mentions the possibility that Crowley himself could have replaced Carl Wegener as Oliver Haddo in Rex Ingram's 1926 film, The Magician. Now, this would have been one of the most remarkable castings in cinema history. Crowley's main love interest, perhaps the great love of his life, was the blonde beauty German-American art student, Hanni Jaeger. He was 56 and she was 19. Hanni would become Crowley's live-in sex magic playmate, art teacher, and model for the next 2 years in 1930s Berlin. She ended up in poor health, apparently due to an excess of 11th degree sex magic operations that Crowley performed to energize his paintings. But they didn't energize Hanni. Crowley had and Hanni faked his suicide as a publicity stunt, both leaping off a seacoast promontory in Portugal. But years later, the emotionally shattered Hanni did take her own life. Crowley was also a voluntary intelligence asset, reporting mainly on communist activity on the German cultural scene to Lieutenant Colonel Nick Carter, the head of Scotland Yard's special branch. That was the origin of Interpol. Nick was a nickname derived from the dime novel or penny dreadful detective Nick Carter. And he is also said to have had an interface with MI5 and SIS. SIS is otherwise known as MI6. Crowley had contacts with Albert Einstein, Alfred Adler, and numerous German intellectuals. He later reported on the rise of Nazism. He had a good sense to leave Germany before their final takeover. Not so Karl Gerber. Karl stayed behind and went twice into the concentration camps. Some of the most interesting aspects of this book are descriptions of Crowley and his friends pub crawling in decadent Weimar Berlin. Through the Beast's eyes, we tour the gay and lesbian bars and cafes, which we may also view in the Toulouse-Lautrecian artwork of the period, which is included with Crowley's art in the color plate section of the book. This is the world of Christopher Isherwood's novel that became the musical Come to the Cabaret. Much of this culture migrated to Hollywood with the German UFA film industry when the Nazis took over and ran the degenerates out. Well, it's up to the reader to decide if we were cursed or blessed by that exodus. Now, Churton ends the book with a eulogy on Crowley and a long polemic on Thelema with his own analysis of why it could never be a political system. As stated in the abstract, this book will be thoroughly enjoyed by Crowley aficionados. Otherwise, it's a hard read unless you are a modern social historian. It certainly finds a place in my library shelf, and with the above qualifications, I would certainly recommend it. Now, that includes the formal review, so let's dip into the book and have some fun finding out how Crowley managed in Germany. Now, those of you who are into Crowley are going to be kind of interested in some of the original background of the OTO in Germany. And so I'll read this section here. Aleister Crowley meets the German New Age. Crowley's first encounter with the German New Age came in the form of a certificate received from a German of remarkably colorful background. Theodore Roos, 1855-1923, had lived a life in journalism, music, poll performance, spying as an infiltrator of socialist and anarchist circles in London for the Prussian secret police, and as Leopold Engel's partner in trying to reestablish Adam Weishaupt's late 18th century Illuminati order in Germany. Today, however, Roos is best known as the co-father of the Ordo Templi Orientis, OTO, and the man who involved Aleister Crowley in that nascent enterprise. The OTO's exclusive path to fruition has recently been uncovered in Richard Kaczynski's Forgotten Templars, The Untold Origins of Ordo Templi Orientis, that's a 2012 publication, revealing how the OTO emerged amid the worlds of fringe masonry and unofficial theosophical societies. In 1883, Bavarian-born emigree Franz Hartmann quit his Colorado medical practice to assist Helena Blavatsky at Theosophical Society headquarters in Adyar, India. The following year, German enthusiasm for the Theosophical Society crystallized when Hamburg's Dr. Wilhelm Hub Schleiden, 1846-1916, became president of a 38-member Theosophic Societ Germania. Please excuse my, I don't do very well with German. You know, about the only German I know is Wasserschloss Das Gasthaus. It's a little bit of GI German. I don't do very well with German, so please forgive me. And one thing, Churton doesn't provide very many translations for his German. which is another criticism of the book. You better be able to understand it. If you can't pronounce it, at least you better be able to understand it. Just as the Theosophical Society was getting going, Annie Blavatsky scandals are cut short Hartman's Theosophical honeymoon in India. In 1885, the Coulomb affair and Britain's Society for Psychical Research, Hodgson report, left Adyar's Theosophical Society leadership discredited for fraudulently fabricating correspondence with alleged hidden masters. Now, let me stop for a minute and explain that for those of you who don't understand it. The Psychic Research Society discovered was that Helena Blavatsky had a little Hindu kid up in the attic dropping these supposed messages from the Mahatmas. That's Ranbir Singh, you know, her sponsor, dropping him through the attic down. So she could pick them up while she was supposedly in trance. And while Hartman accompanied Blavatsky back to Europe, leaving her in Munich in November 1885, Theosophical Society membership slumped in the scandal's wake. And though the Theosophical Society closed in December of 1886, its magazine, The Sphinx, continued for a decade. Theodore Roos would contribute an article in 1894. In 1888, Hartman joined Frederick Eckstein, Dr. Edmund Lang, and his remarkable wife Marie, 1858-1934, in a theosophical study group in Vienna. These groups gave Rudolf Steiner his first taste of theosophy and distaste for what Steiner considered Hartman's symbolic and subjective approach to spiritual knowledge. Notwithstanding the young Steiner's opinion, Hartman had become the Theosophical Society's dominant German apostle. Residing in Austria's historic town of Allian in the state of Salzburg, Hartman encountered the wealthy chemical engineer, inventor, industrialist, and alchemist Karl Kellner, 1850-1905. The affable Kellner was busy constructing a chemical plant to benefit from Allian's ancient salt mines. Kellner spiced his scientific prowess with esoteric philosophy, which had seized his imagination after inheriting his grandfather's papers concerning a secret Rosicrucian fraternity. Age 22, Kellner joined a Masonic lodge in Hungary. Crowley informed Henry Bourbon in 1929 that Roos regarded Kellner as thoroughly outstanding. Crowley himself never doubted Kellner was the OTO's essential genius. Kellner's appreciation of Hartman intensified in 1892 when, having observed byproducts of Kellner's chemical process at Allian, Hartman published his new treatment for respiratory diseases. Kellner found Hartman's transformation of industrial water waste into gold both appealing and amusing. He backed Hartman's inhalatoriums, I guess that's a place where you inhale, where sufferers found relief through chemical inhalation. Hartman doubtless considered himself a new Paracelsus. He wrote a little biography of the great Swiss spiritual reformer who pioneered erotochemical medicine. How tightly knit Germany's New Age scene was becomes apparent when we note that Dr. Hartman's patient, in his inhalation equipment, was marketed in Germany by Leipzig bookseller Heinrich Tranker. And Tranker would become head of the German OTO in 1923 and Crowley's enemy after 1925. Yeah, he Tranker was one of the people that was in the WADA conference. Like Paracelsus, Kellner and Hartmann opened themselves to knowledge regardless of the source. Punjabi yogi Asena Prathapa visited Europe in the summer of 1896, and witnessing Pratapa's demonstrations of yogic sleep, Kellner and Hartmann invited him to Halian, whereupon Kellner wrote a pioneering sketch entitled Yoga, published in Munich. Extraordinary performances by Sufi fakir Suleiman bin Aisa of the Order of Said, Morocco, also inspired the aspiring Neo-Rosicrucians. Possibly trained within the Asiwa mystical brotherhood, Ben Asiwa could pierce his body without pain or blood. Crowley would later claim he learned such skills from an Asiwa adept in Cairo in 1904. Perhaps Crowley encountered Ben Asiwa in Paris and did several leading theosophists and Martinists in 1907. The beast would meet another of Kellner and Hartmann's guides, the fiery Kashmiri Brahmin Mahatma Sri Agamaguru Paramahamsa, who taught Kellner the science of breathing, pranayama. And like Kellner, Crowley would quit his alleged holiness presence, exasperated by the guru's outrageous threats. More than a match for the Swami's pretensions, Crowley learned Hatha Yoga by himself. Now, I'll comment a little bit on that. The OTO likes to give you the impression that the so-called ninth degree is actually influenced by tantric yoga, by Bengali tantra. It is not, and it never has been. It is entirely Western, entirely Gnostic, and this pretty much proves it, because all this is all Hatha yoga, and it doesn't have anything to do with tantra, and so I think they can. The idea with tantric sex magic, I'm digressing here because I want to interpret this information. The idea with tantric sex magic is that there is no, there's 44 minutes without ejaculation, and this is finally transmuted up the chakras, to Sahasraram, whereas the ninth degree is actually uses semen, uses the ejaculation process in consecrating a talisman and whatever. So the two methods are entirely different, and this idea that so here we are learning finally that what Kellner really got. What he really got was not sex magic, not Eastern sex magic, but regular Eastern yoga, which Crowley also was proficient at. So that, I think, is really sort of illuminating in the background of the OTO. Also to digress a little bit, when Theodore Roos visited Crowley in England, Crowley had just published his Book of Lies. And chapter 69, if you want to read something into that, you can. Chapter 69 was sort of a one-paragraph description of the ninth degree Gnostic-type technique. And sometime in the evening, Crowley had a knock on the door. He went to the door, opened it, and there was Theodore Roos standing there and introduced himself. He said, "I'm Theodore Roos." And Crowley said, "Well, what can I do for you?" And Roos said, "You're publishing our secrets." And Crowley, you know, what do you mean I'm publishing your secrets? Come in, for heaven's sake. And so, so Roos came in, and they showed Crowley the chapter in the book of in the book of Lies, and they sat down to brandy and cigars, and before the evening was over, Roos had made Crowley the high king of the OTO, and even asked him to you know, and Crowley introduced him to the law of Thelema, and they got on very well. But later, of course, and as is pointed out in this, book, later, and this is important, Theodore Roos insisted that he not integrate his AA program, his Argentum Astrum program, which was Crowley's televised version of the Golden Dawn's magical program. And he had been integrating that in between the OTO initiations, as it perhaps should be, and Roos insisted that that not be, that they separate the two. And Crowley agreed on it. And strangely enough, that agreement right there, that way back then, has held all the way up to today. And the OTO is crippled in the fact that it can't teach magic, because the magic is in the Argentum Astrum program. Back in the 1960s, Georgina Brayton and a friend of mine whose name I'm not going to mention, in the Solar Lodge, they did this. The Solar Lodge of Maverick, OTO organization, they integrated the AA program in between the degrees, the OTO degrees. And they crashed and burned like so many these orders do. But before they did, they had a very effective program. And that should be done in the OTO today. But Bill Brees and the rest of them, they can't seem to manage to do it. And so the problem is, I hear this all the time from OTO members. Well, I'm in the OTO now. How do I find the AA? You know, and you can't find them. They're around, but you can't find them. Anyway, so that's where that originates. Now, we mentioned that Crowley at one point with his this Scarlet Woman and this beautiful California German Hani Jaeger, that they perpetrated a suicide, a hoax, and this is, I'll read you this. On October 1st, Lieutenant Colonel Carter of Special Branch alerted Gerald York, this is in London, to a frantic communication from Marie Crowley. She had read of her husband's disappearance in Portugal in the papers, probably in the Empire News, in which the following appeared at the end of September 1930. Headline, Famous Mystic or His Double. Message pinned to Mouth of Cave, Vanished Couple. A mysterious note pinned to the entrance of a cave known as Hell's Mouth, 20 miles from Lisbon. And the disappearance of a beautiful girl figure in the mysterious case of a man believed to be Aleister Crowley, the notorious English mystic, who is well known in London and Paris, and special to the Empire News. The mystery of the disappearance in Portugal of a man giving the name of Aleister Crowley deepens every day. The real Aleister Crowley is known as an author and a poet, and also a kind of mystic and magician. And he is also much criticized and has been described by some of his critics as the worst man in England. The French police ordered him to leave France last year. A man purporting to be Aleister Crowley recently turned up at a hotel in Estoril near Lisbon, accompanied by a beautiful young German girl who gave the name of Miss Hani Jaeger. One night, there was a terrible scene in the hotel, the lady having hysterics and threatening to kill herself, and both were requested by the hotel management to leave the next day. The passport. Since then, both the supposed Aleister Crowley and the fascinating Holly Yeager have disappeared from public view, although the police have tried to find out what has become of them. They discovered that the man with the passport bearing Crowley's name and description actually crossed the Portuguese frontier. Yet, a few days later, further discoveries caused the mystery to deepen. The missing man is believed to have been seen still on Portuguese territory. Nothing so far has been heard of the lady, who is presumed to be still in Portugal. What was added to the mystery is the discovery of a letter said to be from Crowley and addressed to Hani Yeager, pinned to a rock. It was found pinned to a rock at the entrance to the cave, known as Hell's Mouth, 20 miles from Lisbon. And it said, "Year 14, sun in the scales of LGPI. I cannot live without thee. The other mouth of hell will catch me. It will not be as hot as thine. Pisos, tuli you." What all this means, nobody can guess. Are there two Crowleys, one genuine and one imposter? Inquiry at some of the real Aleister Crowley's favorite resorts in London reveal that he has not been seen at them for some time and is presumed to be out of the country. Is the mystical letter a fake or a practical joke put up by somebody who has borrowed Crowley's name for the occasion? Well, anyway, Crowley got a lot of publicity out of this, which is what he intended. Let's go on with this a little bit. Hysterics. On September 18th, I received a letter from Crowley. I'm trying to find out who wrote this. On September 18th, I received a letter from Crowley stated Senor Pessoa. He's a Portuguese poet who Crowley used to play chess with, saying that Miss Yeager had a terrible attack of hysterics and had disappeared, leaving merely two lines in pencil that she was going to return. On September 23rd, he told me that he was going again to Sintra, which had enchanted him, and that he would spend some days there. He authorized me to receive his correspondence, forwarded to Cook's agency, so that I could get some books intended for me. He did not leave me any instructions concerning the rest of his correspondence. After this, I swear that I saw Crowley twice, on September 24th, once at the Rosio Street and once at the Café de Sodré, entering the English tobacco shop. Nevertheless, the police state that he crossed the frontier on September 23rd. Did he actually cross? Or did he both cross and return? Nick Carter reassured Marie only that morning he had received a card from Crowley in Berlin. Judging from the external communications, the card might have illuminated the political situation. Adolf Hitler had been barred from sitting in the Reichstag as he was an Austrian citizen. Shares in the Bruce fell as the world registered that the Jew and Bolshevik denouncing Nazis were now Germany's largest political party after the Social Democrats. That day, Carter wrote to Gerald York. Crowley received the following wire from Pessoa. Letter, cigarette case identified as Crowley's, discovered evening 25th, mouth of hell, police investigating, doubt suicide, though nothing definite ascertained. Now, that's all part of Crowley's, plants and for the hoax. So, he got a lot of publicity out of that. But unfortunately, later on, Hani Yeager did commit suicide, although nobody quite knows where or how that happened, but certain is fairly certain she did. Now, the espionage aspects of this are, I'm sure, quite interesting to Curly fans. But let's have a little background. Before I read this chapter 16 on spying, let me give you a little, catch up a little background on Curly and Curly and espionage. During World War I, Curly lived in New York and worked, it's the only job he ever had in his life, by the way. He worked for Sylvester Weyrich, a German journalist and novelist, he worked for Sylvester Weyrich at a paper, a German American paper that Weyrich was putting out, which was of course pro German. And Curly was posing with Weyrich. Curly was posing as an Irish German sympathizer. You know, the Irish rebellious faction had in both wars were suspected of conspiring with the Germans against the British. So Curly used that as a means of convincing Weyrich that he was anti-British, and that he could write anti-British propaganda. And so Weyrich set him to doing that, and Curly claims now. Curly claimed that he was, this was after the war, when he got called to task for all of this. Curly claimed that he was really doing this with the approval of and in communication with British intelligence. Now, whether this was British naval intelligence or whether it is what, I don't think it was MI6, but he was he claimed he was doing this and he was in touch with British intelligence. That claim, by the way, has been disputed by a number of people. But Curly claimed that he was writing this outrageous propaganda, anti British propaganda, that he believed. It was so outrageous that it would not appeal even to the German Americans. Whether or not, of course, some of this involved the Lusitania. Curly was, fulminating, wrote something about the warning people not to sail on the Lusitania and whatever. But, Curly excused this, as I said, by claiming that he was doing this in cahoots with British intelligence. But now, in his confessions, he pictures Sylvester Weyrich as a buffoon that he could fool. There's one little problem with this. Sylvester Weyrich was the author of one of the most sophisticated and erudite historical novels of that period. And that was my first 2,000 years, The Story of the Wandering Jew. And this was on the bestseller list in America, Germany, and everything else for years. It was a very, very popular and a very, very well done, very erudite historical novel. So it doesn't seem like Sylvester Weyrich, with that, the novel being as sophisticated and as subtle as it is, it doesn't appear that Sylvester Weyrich was that much of a fool. He was not an umpapad German like Curly pretends. So there is, as I say, there has been dispute about whether or not Curly really was a British intelligence asset during World War One. That is disputable. However, during World War Two, this business in Berlin with Nick Carter and Special Branch, this is probably very, very accurate because we got a lot of correspondence here that backs this up. So Curley was serving his country, but he wasn't being paid. He was not receiving, although Carter did help him. You know, Curley was begging money from everybody, and Carter actually helped him. It's to some degree in getting his money. But however, Scotland Yard was not paying Curley, and in World War II, when Curley was living in England after he had left Germany, at that time he was again an asset for British intelligence. Rudolf Hess, the deputy Führer of Nazi Germany and a very close friend of Hitler's, Rudolf Hess took off in a Messerschmitt 110, twin engine Messerschmitt, and with his own peace plan, and some people say letters to the head of the Golden Dawn at that time, which, God, Lord, the head of the Golden Dawn at that time was Billy Yeats, and Billy Yeats wouldn't have anything to do with him. But apparently this was Lord Hamilton, and Hess, who was something of an occultist, was going to try to make peace. And Hitler really didn't want to fight the British. He actually admired the British Empire, and he really did want. But he didn't put Hess up to this, apparently. Hess came up with this idea. Well, perhaps Hitler gave him Martian permission. We don't know. We'll never really know, because Hess died in prison in Britain. But anyway, here Hess flies over, parachutes out, and surrenders to the British. He can't get a hold of Lord Hamilton. He surrenders to the British, taken into custody, and here they have this very, very high Nazi official, and they have to interrogate him. Well, we know that Hess is an occultist, so MI6 puts together a team. And they bring in Ian Fleming of Naval Intelligence. They bring in Dennis Wheatley, who was a author of occult novels, and then they bring in Aleister Crowley as an asset. Now, an asset is not an agent, not an officer, When some of my polemic friends tell me that, oh, well, Curley was an intelligence officer for... No, he was an asset. He was an asset. He says in World War One, he was certainly an asset in Germany before the war. And again, he was an asset in World War Two with the Hess interrogation. And unfortunately, he didn't get paid for that. He didn't get paid. They didn't pay him for his work in World War II. But at least we can say that he was. Now, I'm going to read this chapter on spying in the book here, because we got time left for doing it. Okay. On Sunday, 15 November 1931, Crowley's cinematic ambitions coalesced strangely with Berlin street politics. The day was Toten Sonntag, Dead Sunday, Eternity Sunday, established in 1816 as a holy day for Lutheran churches to remember the dead, especially Prussian war dead. Philip Nicolai's Awake, The Voice Calls Us, was sung, and that chant now rang with all the hoarse insistence of a summons to resistance by royalists, eager to restore the Hohenzollern monarchy that had collapsed with Germany's bitter surrender in 1918. You know, that's Kaiser Wilhelm's, you know. The venue for the anti-Republican demonstration was the Guess Monastery, a red brick church at Stargartenstrasse 77, Berlin North, intended at its dedication by Kaiser Wilhelm II in 1893 as a bulwark against socialism, communism, and atheism. It was now a shelter for radical pro-Republican socialist groups. When royalists crowded the church, the act was deliberately politically provocative. The war dead would indeed be remembered. Germany, they exclaimed, had been betrayed. A strikingly modern ticket to Crowley's Porza exhibition survives at London's Warburg Institute. On its reverse is a secret handwritten note signed 666 to Nick, Lieutenant Colonel Carter, head of Special Branch, London, about the Dead Sunday Clash. The Hitler-Hindenburg crowd want to bring them, the Hohenzollerns, back. They will be in power probably before Christmas. But that will mean French intervention, also revolution, ending in anarchy, with a probable attempt of the Soviets to capture the country. It means the smash all around. Now, I'll explain that. Crowley is revealing that the Nazis were bringing Kaiser Bill's relatives, the Hohenzollerns, back into the Nazi movement. And they actually succeeded in doing that. But Crowley's prediction did not take place. Believing Hitler would back the Hohenzollern restoration, the ex-Kaiser had permitted sons August, Wilhelm, and Oscar to join the NSDAP, that's the Nazi Party, in 1930. Hitler played the Hohenzollerns along, as the art show ticket demonstrates. Crowley foresaw the end of the Weimar Republic. Well, that he did, because that was the Weimar Republic's days were numbered at that point. Precisely how Lieutenant Colonel Carter saw Crowley's intelligence role in Berlin is unknown. But surviving evidence permits us to call Crowley an intelligence asset. And since he disguised his activities, we may call him a spy, though not one employed by the British security services for money. Crowley served his country for the hell of it. At the outbreak of World War II in September 1939, Crowley did apply formally for Naval Intelligence Department employment, outlining past services. He summarized his intelligence work for the Allies in the United States during World War I, when he infiltrated the New York-based German propaganda cabinet, a committee of agents and diplomats that included George Sylvester Viereck, Professor Hugo Munsterberg, Harvard University, Berlin's ambassador to the United States, Graf Johann von Bernstorff, and military attaché Franz von Papen, indicted for sabotage in the U.S. in 1916. Crowley's secret effort aimed to supply them with false information and to wreck their propaganda by inducing them to make psychological blunders, all with the object of inducing the U.S. to enter the war on our side. Crowley also referred to his work for Colonel Carter, easy for the NID, the Naval Intelligence Division, to validate. In 1927, I began to work for Special Branch, and this time to work and report on communist activities, especially in Berlin, where I lived almost continuously for 3 years. Crowley gave the name of the Privy Councillor and Parliamentary Liberal Party leader, Sir Percy Harris, first Baronet, as one of his four personal references. The Director of Naval Intelligence invited Crowley for an interview on 10 September 1939. By the way, Ian Fleming was in Naval Intelligence, and so they probably did
Fleming and Crowley probably did get together during the Hess interrogation. Predictably, British security services have not yet deemed it in their interest to acknowledge any intelligence role for Aleister Crowley. Evidence for Crowley's secret activities is understandably sparse, but not insignificant. His diaries offer clues, but Crowley was living in Germany and his records were vulnerable to confiscation, and he had been publicly suspected of being a spy for Germany when permission to reside in France was rescinded in 1929. By the way, he was kicked out of Italy by Mussolini, when he had that abbey down in Sicily. The case for Crowley's spying has been called impossibly flimsy, The Telegraph, London, 7 September 2011. And so we begin with the flimsiest evidence of all, a dream of 26 November 1931. Dream. I was made Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary, but the king was Wilhelm II. And the place was Paris. And I walked up the boulevard with Ramsay MacDonald, British Prime Minister in 1929, and discussed policy, warning him that he had some months before got Carter after him. Ramsay MacDonald was the first British Labour Party minister. His party was full of communist sympathizers. In 1924, the famous Zeno Zev letter, a forged allegedly Soviet instruction to activate civil war in Great Britain through socialist networks, beefed up conservative opposition to MacDonald's election as Labour Prime Minister, but did not prevent it. And at the time, Lieutenant Colonel Carter, late of the Imperial General Staff, was Deputy Assistant Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. The interface with British Home Secretary, MI5, Home Security Services, MI5, before his highly distinguished Army career in World War I, Carter had served in the Indian Police in Burma. The chief threats to security in Great Britain under his watch were communism and renegade Irish Republicans. Between 1928 and 31, Carter had become concerned with possible Soviet funding of the IRA, the irregular, and corresponded with David Nelligan, head of the Irish Free States Garda Special Branch, on the subject. Foreign exploitation of the IRA was familiar territory to Crowley, who had enjoyed inside knowledge of the 1914-15 plot of von Bernstorff and Sir Roger Casement to activate pro-German rebellion in Ireland. And, of course, he used that, as we know, to get in good with Sylvester Weyrich in New York. Crowley and Bill was one of his scarlet women, by the way. Bill, and remember, this is the Weimar Republic, and most of many of the women in the Weimar Berlin were wearing suits and ties and men's hats. Crowley and Bill's paying lodger, Gerald Hamilton, had been interred during World War I for his opposition to the war. Hamilton had also been associated with Casement, who was executed. Churchill would inter Hamilton in Brixton Jail briefly in World War II for his vocal opposition to the war and for his intrigues with the Roman Catholic Church, to the end that through contacts in neutral Dublin and elsewhere, more of this Irish Republican stuff, Hamilton was a communist and also homosexual. In early January 1932, Crowley worked with Hamilton on a book about Berlin. Crowley enjoyed ample opportunity for regular conversations with Hamilton, whose autobiography revealed his ignorance at the time of Crowley's intentions. The gift of £50 given to Crowley by the British government to report on my activities in Berlin. I naturally never knew of this until after Crowley's death, when his literary executor, John Simons, and another close friend, Gerald York, gave me the proof. What is piquant in this matter is that on one of my journeys to London, Gerald York asked me to take some English money back to Berlin and give it to Crowley. And this I did, and the amount entrusted to me was £50 in cash that my host had earned by writing a report upon my very harmless activities. Hamilton was mistaken about the money. It came from Crowley's trust. And the government never paid, you know, British government never paid Crowley. Got a lot of work out of him, but they never paid him. On 26 January 1932, Crowley had written to York about maintaining his cover so as to get the best out of Hamilton, highlighting the risks involved in his double life. Yeah, so this gives you a pretty good idea of what I'll read a little bit more here. If he, Hamilton, should learn that I am, as I was born, an English high Tory patriot, my usefulness would be over. And if he should even suspect that I have any relations to Nick Carter beyond pulling his leg, there would be work for you within a week or two with the embalmer. Uh-oh. Really getting a little paranoid here. So please avoid discussing my politics, or if forced to do so, say you regard me as at least 80% a Bolshevik. Note added by Gerald York. AC was informing against Hamilton, who had communist connections to Carter. Please take this most seriously and be cautious as you know how. I hear that Annie Besant is in senile dementia and moribund. She may die any day now. It is most urgent that I should be instantly and widely proclaimed as H.P.B. Blavatsky's legitimate successor. As to my reputation, I am the silent martyr, Jesuit Khomeini, and the shining token of my mission. Throw yourself into this wholeheartedly, and we come right to the big end of the horn with Nick Carter and all England, too, and two shakes of her rat's whiskers. You can talk freely to Hamilton about my mission with the Law of Thelema. He can help with broadcasting the proclamation. Only avoid politics like poison. He thinks that I want to use the Theosophical Society to help communism. Encourage that idea. Okay, that's enough of that. Now, next week, yeah, are we gonna go next week? Yeah, you know, next week, around New Year's, we're going to investigate a political-economic cult that flourished back in the 1930s in the United States and in England, which may very well have carried on and had something to do with some of the intrigues and the situations going on today. So next week, Theocracy Rising, and that ought to be very interesting. It's along the same lines as what we've been discussing. So next week, Theocracy Rising, and until then, good magic.